Hello, this is Jay Stowe, picking up from where I left off last week, reading from the Esquire Super Retro Special Issue, their summer issue, picking up where I left off and reading The Secret Oral History, which covers the writers Donna Tartt, Bret Easton Ellis, Jonathan Lethem, and a number of other people who attended Bennington College in the early to mid-80s. 1985-86 school year graduation. Jonathan Lethem. My Bennington career is just so distended and awkward. Okay, so I was living in California, but I was in love with a girl at Bennington, Susan Goldman, and I ended up coming back and staying with Susan for much of what would have been my senior year. I was writing my novel in her dorm room and sneaking into the dining hall. Bret Easton Ellis. Returning to campus in September was tricky. This book I'd written, which felt highly personal to me, had somehow become a bestseller and cultural touchstone. My friends were older, and they were gone. It seemed like every day journalists were coming to campus to see me. I was this freak. I realized it didn't matter if I went to class. I started the Rules of Attraction. It was a very lonely year. Maura Spiegel. I did a tutorial with Bret his senior year. I said to him, and I think this was about the Rules of Attraction, Bret, these characters aren't coming alive for me. Like this scene with this woman character. Now, would your friend so-and-so behave like this? And he said, that is so-and-so. That is how she behaved. Paula Powers. I was at Oxford for my junior year, and during that time, Bret became famous. When I came back, he always had this crew of young men around him. They were fans, but he kind of liked them, too, you know? Lawrence, Larry, David. Bret was very good at getting straight guys to sleep with him. They all wanted to be writers, and he was very charming, so he could convince them to, like, give it a try. Bret Easton Ellis. MTV invited me and Jay to the Video Music Awards in September. I started spending more time in New York. Amy Herskovitz. Bret would get a room at the Carlyle. We'd drink, do a shit ton of drugs, go to clubs. We were wild and out of control. We'd be the youngest people in all these places. Bret could get in anywhere. We'd see his dad in the city. His dad was a big guy, very masculine, bloated, but likable in a way. He'd rent a limo and want to get drunk and high, go out. He was violently shaming of Bret. There was this time when a woman, young, our age, gave Bret's dad head under the table at a club in front of Bret. It was so wrong. It was bad for Bret, bad for Bret's dad, bad for the girl. Bret Easton Ellis. Spring semester, I failed a couple classes. There was a lot of, should Bret graduate? Talk. I did. Donna gave the speech. Donna Tartt, commencement speech. There is a time in everyone's youth when character is fixed forever. For me, and I believe for most of us here, our Bennington years were that time. Jonathan Lethem. I was actually at the graduation that would have been my graduation because it was Susan's graduation. I was like Huck Finn at his own funeral. Amy Herskovitz. Bret's dad made a pass at me at the ceremony. I was horrified on Bret's behalf. Imagine Bret having to live with his dad doing this to someone everyone thought was his girlfriend. Sari Rubinstein. In New York, in the 80s, Andy Warhol ruled. If you were at the right party, then Andy was there. I rode in the elevator with him to Bret's graduation party at the Carlyle. The party was fabulous and amazing. Everybody was trashed. Andy Warhol, from the Diaries, entry for June 16, 1986. I decided to go with Keith Haring to the Carlyle for a party for the Ellis kid, who wrote Less Than Zero. It was such a cute party. All the kids had the right fashionable hair and the right fashionable clothes. Jerry Howard, editor. Now, I'm a nice boy from Brooklyn, and what I encountered at that party I'd never encountered before. Just this air of blasé corruption. I was 15 years older than everybody there, and I felt like one of the less experienced people in the room. Post-graduation, 1986 to 92. Bret Easton Ellis. I was more often in Jay's crowd than he was in mine, which makes sense. I was still with a bunch of 21-year-olds who'd just graduated from Bennington. He was in the crowd that everyone wanted to be a part of. Amy Herskovitz. It was Jay, of course, and Gary Fiskachon, editor at Knopf, and Morgan. Andy Warhol was around, and David Byrne, and the Brat Pack. Judd Nelson, Andrew McCarthy, Molly Ringwald, Robert Downey Jr., Michael J. Fox when he was starring in Bright Lights, Big City, Jay McInerney. Jim, a lawyer, not out professionally, was around for a long time before he was acknowledged as the boyfriend. I finally took Brett to task for it. I said, "Do you think I'm stupid or homophobic? Because I ain't neither." Brett Easton Ellis. Jay's always so surprised that I never talked to him about my gayness, even though I certainly wasn't pretending to be straight. Then Jim came into the picture, and we were living together. That's when Jay noticed and was like, "Why didn't you ever tell me?" "I don't even know what coming out is. I never came out. For me, it was neither here nor there, but other people got riled up about it, and Jay was one of them." Amy Herskovitz. "I loved Jim. Jim was a gentleman." Brett Easton Ellis. "I got a little of Patrick Bateman from Jim, who was waspy, very good-looking, totally straight-acting, and in the closet." Donna was dating Jim's best friend, Bill. This was the early 90s. American Psycho had just come out. There was a lot of cocaine around, and Donna was into it. This is not like she's a druggie. We were all doing it. One night, I asked her what she thought of American Psycho. She wouldn't answer. I'll never forget the expression on her face in the darkness of Jim's loft. She had this rictus smile that was also a glare. I felt she wanted to say, "Your book is god-awful," but by force of etiquette, even wasted on coke in the middle of the night, she wouldn't go there. Soon after, she and Gary Fiskejohn started hooking up, and she left Bill, and I saw her less. Jay McInerney. We were really debauched, everybody diving in and going completely berserk. Donna was very much a participant in everything, but at the same time, she wasn't there every night. Would come and go. She was spending a lot of time going away to write, retreating to Vermont or the South. Amy Herskovitz. Donna's tolerance was higher than anyone's I've ever seen, ever, ever, for alcohol, for drugs. Brett Easton Ellis. I think Donna dedicated The Secret History to me because I shaved off a couple of years of it moving through the system. I got it to Binky, Urban, the ICM agent. Donna was grateful, but she felt indebted to me for something I was happy to do. It was a pleasure reading those pages for a decade. Ian Gittler. Donna was this unknown, unpublished writer, and then, all of a sudden, there was this huge bidding war for her book, and the movie rights were sold. Brett started calling her Madonna Tart. Jonathan Leatham, from Zelig of Notoriety. No one had ever seen a first novel hoisted past reviewers into legend by a publicity machine, or if they had, they'd forgotten. Every person I recalled from our time at Bennington seemed reworked in Donna's pages, except I saw no spot for myself, unless, as I joked to my girlfriend, it was the murdered Vermont farmer. Sari Rubenstein. I cherish The Secret History because it saves that time of my life. I'll have it forever because of that book. Todd O'Neill. The Secret History isn't a work of fiction. It's a work of thinly veiled reality, a roman à clef. When it came out, Claude and Matt and I got endless calls. Everybody was saying, "Oh, did you know Donna just wrote a book about Claude and you all? And Claude is Julian, and Matt is Bunny, and you're Henry." Matt Jacobson. I called my mother and said, "I've been caricatured in a book, and my character gets killed." And she said, "No, no. No one would ever kill you, not even in print. No." Then she read the book and said, "That's you all right." I wore wire-rimmed glasses like Bunny. I had dyslexia like Bunny. And I'd invite people to lunch and then realize I didn't have any money, something dear old Bunny does. I was kind of a horrible bounder, though in my case it was never intentional. Todd O'Neill. I might well have been capable of tearing a farmer to shreds while running through the woods naked, screaming Greek. I don't know. I never did. Matt Jacobson. I was living in California in 1985, and lo and behold, Donna calls me in my little slum apartment. She starts asking me questions. I realize later it was her wanting to know, how would Bunny answer this? Todd O'Neill. Henry's apartment was like my apartment. I smoked Lucky Strikes. I wore suspenders and glasses. I was very deep into the study of Plato and Plotinus, as Henry is described as being. And what Henry said about Julian, "I loved him more than anyone in the world," was true of how I felt about Claude. He was the single greatest influence on my life. Matt Jacobson. The idea of Claude having a big Nouveau Riche pile of Mont Blancs was really too much. Todd O'Neill. No, the Mont Blancs were true, but it was a piece of accidentalia that Donna seized on and used in a pointed way. Donna's Julian is Claude through a glass darkly. Claude considered it a betrayal, not a personal betrayal so much as a betrayal of his teachings. He wouldn't talk to Donna for years. James Kaplan, journalist, from Smart Tart, Vanity Fair, 1992. The Secret History's narrator, Richard Pappin, hails from the fictional and deadly Plano, California, where his father runs a gas station and his mother is a secretary. Tart is highly guarded, to say the least, about any relationship between the novel and her own life, but there is surely common ground. Don Tart was an upwardly mobile small-town operator who owned a freeway service station. His wife, Taylor, was a secretary for much of the time they were married. Donna Tart, interviewed in The Bennington Voice, October 28, 1992. Richard is actually a very skewed character. His sexuality is kind of weird. He's so paranoid about where he comes from, and that's a large part of the paranoia of the book, his fear of being found out. Todd O'Neill. The incestuous twins, though, I don't know where Donna got them. Donna Tart, letter to Jonathan Lethem, dated February 25, 1983. Paul and I were almost kicked out of our lodgings last Tuesday. The charges? Incest. That's really rather impressive, isn't it? Fortunately, we are not brother and sister, or else we would have been quite guilty. Our landlords are minor and despicable Nazis, and even though we were as pure of incest as babes in arms, by proving ourselves innocent of that, we proved ourselves guilty in their eyes of immoral conduct. Todd O'Neill. Claude was a seeker more than anything else. That's where Donna gets it wrong. We weren't these silly pedants going around translating Greek into Latin or whatever she has us doing. Claude was, I was, trying to find a way to live well in order to die well, the same as Socrates and Plato. I think that's why people are still to this day fascinated by Donna's book. It's not the potboiler part, the murder mystery, that fascinates them. It's the part that Claude gave her. Even though nobody knows ancient Greek, and probably wouldn't spend the time learning it if they were given a free opportunity, they still sense something valid and beautiful there, something that the modern world doesn't provide. Matt Jacobson. 10 years after Bennington, I met Paul at his office in New York. He said that Donna had lived with him while he was at Harvard Law, and she was writing, and then dumped him like a hot potato when the book was accepted. He was very wounded talking about her. I long felt that Donna was the Yoko Ono of the Greek class. If she couldn't be part of our tight group, she would destroy it. And that's what happened. Our friendships fell apart. Jonathan Lethem. Bennington... Oh, sorry. The subhead. The Purge, 1994. Jonathan Lethem. Bennington was the last preserve of a decadent old culture that fascinated and appalled everyone. Because of its special properties of isolation and eccentricity, it got to be the place that was that way the longest. What had been quietly and carefully distilled out of other atmospheres hadn't been confronted there. That's why when the purge came, it was such a convulsive thing. The New York Times, from Bennington Means Business, October 23, 1994. This year, Bennington is running a $1 million deficit. A third of the school's faculty members, many of them tenured, received registered letters informing them in taut legal language that their services were no longer called for. Virtually one person, the president, Elizabeth Coleman, 1987 to 2013, has made all the decisions about firing and retention. Todd O'Neill. Elizabeth Coleman needed a pretext to get rid of Claude, and then a student claimed that Claude had hit on him. A witch hunt started, and Claude was ousted. Donna's book was Elizabeth Coleman's unwitting accomplice, because it sowed the seed that there might be something insidious in what he was doing. I saw Bennington as Plato's Academy in America. Elizabeth Coleman destroyed that. Matt Jacobson. It was never unfriendly between me and Claude, but I fell more deeply in love with Liz Glotzer. I saw less of Claude. But as I fell more deeply in love with Liz Glotzer, I saw less of Claude. I realized it was kind of ridiculous to hang out with him. cool as he was. And he wasn't going to get what he wanted from me, so he moved on to greener pastures, started fooling around with another guy who'd been his student. At the end of the day, Claude was driven by a, you know, perverse interest in me. And that was wrong. I'm a geezer now, and I understand how wrong he really was. Jonathan Lethem. How did I feel about the purge? I felt that something precious and remarkable was being destroyed. And I felt that justice was being meted out to people who'd been manipulating students under the guise of mentoring them for a long time. I was just as mixed up about that as I was about all the rest of Bennington. Beyond the Purge, 1994 to present. Jonathan Lethem. In Fortress of Solitude, published in 2003, I wrote about Bennington in a very direct way, barely fictionalizing, which is unusual for me. It seemed funny that I ended up doing what both Brett and Donna, Jill Eisenstadt as well, had done so long after they'd done it. Calling Bennington Camden, Brett's name for Bennington, was my way of tipping my hat, saying, "This is your fictional terrain, but I'm going to occupy it momentarily." Brett Easton Ellis. I became aware of Jonathan as a writer when this galley came to me in the early 90s. It was like, Jonathan Lethem is a writer? I kept up with all his books after that, but I never quite connected with them. Then Fortress came out. At first, I couldn't get into it. I was reading too fast. So I slowed down and I got swept up in it. I think it's one of the great books of our generation. Jonathan Lethem. In 2005, I came back to Bennington to give the commencement address. At the time, Bennington was extremely uneasy about its cocaine years past, and therefore had to pretend that Brett's and Donna's writing didn't exist. Then I came along. The irony is, I do have that chapter about Bennington and Fortress that should have been appalling to them, but my book doesn't wear on its sleeve that I went to the most corrupt, decadent college in the country, so I weirdly became the safe one for them to claim. Giving that address, me, the sophomore on leave, was an amazing piece of closure. Here I was on the grounds again and in the president's embrace. In a funny sense, it was graduation day for me. It's like I went where I failed to go. Valedictories. Brett Easton Ellis. Bennington was built for me. It was exactly what I was looking for. Everything about the campus, the people I met, the setting itself, the freedom I was given. It was a truly blissful period. Yes, there was tension, and yes, there was heartache. But overall, I loved it. I absolutely loved it. Jonathan Lethem. Bennington was, for me, as formative and influential as it could possibly be. I'll never be done with that place. Donna Tartt, from an interview in The Guardian, October 26, 2013. When were you happiest? Answer, at Bennington. Next up, I will switch back to the September issue of Esquire and read from the Big Bite, a cultural guide to just about everything. Just enough of everything, sorry. This is in the front of the book. Under the slug movies, the headline, Take Back the Stream, Bust Out of the Netflix Cultural Bubble with These Five Alternative Services, by Ash Carter. Being mad at Netflix is like yelling at the tide. There is no alternative. One cannot survive on Hulu or HBO Now alone. And besides, it makes some damn good content. Television doesn't get better than The Crown or Wild Wild Country, both Netflix originals. The company's aggressive push into film has not been uncontroversial, but Hollywood had long since ceded the territory. The studios simply aren't in the business of making movies about people born without superpowers, let alone black-and-white foreign arthouse fare like last year's Roma. So my beef is not with Netflix, or Hulu, or Amazon. It's with us. We declared our independence by cord-cutting, only to be algorithmized into docility. Netflix was founded in 1997 to disrupt Blockbuster, but the advent of cost-effective streaming, a little under a decade ago, was like the discovery of a new continent, and Netflix was the first to plant its flag. To fully understand why streaming is so much more than a technological advance, we have to go back to 1948 and the landmark antitrust decision known as the Paramount Decree. That year, the Supreme Court ruled that movie studios could not own movie theaters, which they did up to that point. Streaming has offered an end run around this inconvenient ruling. Now, Netflix and its peers, like the upcoming Apple TV Plus and Disney Plus, are free to produce, distribute, and promote their own products right into the palm of your own hand, a level of vertical integration the moguls of old Hollywood could only dream about. Much has been written about the fire hose of quality programming endlessly blowing us all away like the guy in the Maxell commercial. But that's the problem. The content comes faster than you can watch it. Trying to keep up with the water cooler crowd is the road to madness, and it leaves no time for discovering anything else. We need to be nudged beyond our comfort zones, and the data set generated by our viewing habits isn't going to do it. Here are a few other services designed to help you step outside the closed loop of Because You Watched. The Criterion Channel. From the ashes of Filmstruck, a short-lived joint venture between Criterion and Turner Classic Movies, rose the Criterion Channel, launched earlier this year, and it's larded with arthouse classics, among them Seven Samurai and Eight and a Half, as well as loads of informative interviews and extras guaranteed to improve your film literacy. $11 per month or $100 per year. Fandor. Fandor has been gaining a reputation among cinephiles for its eclectic 5,000 film library. How eclectic? Scroll through the documentaries and you'll find the fascinating Our Nixon, the awesomely trashy heavy metal parking lot, and the very Orson Welles-y British miniseries Around the World with Orson Welles, $6 per month or $50 per year. Canopy. To open a Canopy account, all you need is a library card. The number of movies you can stream per month is limited. The exact figure depends on your library, but the selection is a rich one, from recent independent jewels like Leave No Trace and Four Lions, to silent classics like Buster Keaton's The General and F.W. Murnau's Nosferatu, free with a library card. Mubi. Mubi takes the curated approach a step further. The selection is limited to 30 movies, and it's one in, one out. Each day, a movie is added and another disappears. Mubi also distributes select offbeat films to theaters, such as the music documentary Ryuichi Sakamoto, Coda. $11 per month for 30 movies. La Cinema Club. The Cinema Club is even more audaciously austere, showing just one little scene movie per week. Founded in 2015, it was relaunched in June with Claire Denis's long-lost 1991 short film, Keep It For Yourself. Previous offerings have included the student work of Barry Jenkins and Alfonso Cuarón. Free. Tech. Rediscover the DVD player. It'll raise your film IQ. Many millennials seem to regard owning a DVD player as an eccentricity akin to using a flip phone or smoking a pipe. I, however, consider it an essential part of my home entertainment system, such as it is, at least for the time being. Consider this statistic. Of the roughly 4,100 movies currently available on Netflix, just 69, that's 1.7%, are older than Pete Buttigieg. Yes, the selection is better than renting from iTunes, Google Play, etc., but those charges add up, and there are many titles that can't be streamed, period. To take three examples from my own modest collection, Paolo Sorrentino's Il Divo, a compilation of UPA cartoons, and The Complete Sergeant Bilko. Don't expect a vinyl-style revival. DVDs are a bridge technology. But I wouldn't burn that bridge just yet. Entertaining. The clear winner. Vodka is often vilified as boring by the cocktail cognoscenti. It's time to ignore them and pour yourself a very cold one. I went to Siberia once. That's not a metaphor. I flew to Novosibirsk, a Russian city northeast of Kazakhstan, and then ventured out into the taiga to experience the Siberian ritual known as the banya, which is sort of a sauna treatment with a touch of 50 Shades of Grey. The banya involves sitting in a room as hot as a pizza oven and being smacked with branches from a birch tree until you can't take it anymore, at which point you flee the steam, douse yourself with cold water, and lie naked in the snow. I recommend it. When I was finished being parboiled and spanked, I put on my clothes and wandered into a dining room where I found something of a gift. At every place setting waited a bottle of local vodka. Each person who had endured the banya received his own. If I hadn't given vodka much serious thought before my trip, that dinner in Siberia turned my head around, so to speak. in the warmth of that room, surrounded by the bracing cold of a Russian night. Shots of clear elixir just made sense, like rum in the Caribbean or single malt in the Hebrides. In the years that followed, I watched vodka itself get spanked by cocktail snobs who viewed it as little more than a crude delivery system for alcohol. Death and Company, the famous bar in New York City's East Village, refused even to stock it. And mostly I kept my mouth shut during that dark period, while happily storing several bottles of the stuff in my freezer at home. I like to sip something when I'm cooking, and for my money, few countertop companions are more satisfying, in both the haze of summer and the dead of winter, than cold, viscous vodka in a small glass, all by itself. Its bracing austerity is precisely what makes it appealing. A few bartenders may have tried to banish it to Siberia. That is a metaphor. But people should drink what they want. I recommend it. Vodkas with verve. Sipping it chilled? Go for a bottle with nuance and proudly consider yourself a vodka connoisseur. Kevin Sintumawong. Oh, the previous piece was written by Jeff Gordonier. Nika Coffee Vodka. Zesty, creamy, smooth. Boyd and Blair Potato Vodka. Lightly sweet, very luscious. St. George Green Chili Vodka. Farm Fresh Flavors. Absolute Elix. Chalky yet perfectly crisp. Pologar Classic Rye Vodka. Rich and bread-like. A Food Prophet of Harlem. Chef J.J. Johnson's Cuisines Have Always Been Revelatory, by Jeff Gordonier. 5 years ago, in the fall of 2014, this magazine named The Cecil the best new restaurant in America. Josh Azurski, the writer who made that pick, raised a toast to the pioneering menu. Quote, primed and loaded with the flavors of the African diaspora, that trail of taste that moved from West Africa to India, the Caribbean to America, to China, and then back again. Unquote. Meanwhile, Eater, the influential food blog that in recent years has rebooted itself into a bully pulpit for diversity, seemed slightly bewildered that a black-owned restaurant in Harlem might merit the top spot on a national list. Josh Ozersky confounds expectations, said the Eater headline, while the piece itself quipped that, quote, it sounds like Ozersky is out to stir things up, end quote. Ozersky is gone now. He died the next year, and the Cecil has abandoned its original vision. Now it's a neighborhood steakhouse. But half a decade on, it's clear that Esquire's selection of the Cecil was a prescient one. In the intervening years, chefs like Masha Mabaley, Kwame Anwuachi, Eduardo Jordan, Nina Compton, Pierre Thiam, and Eric Ajapong have drawn national attention and, in several cases, James Beard Awards for exploring the African diaspora through cooking. The long-overdue rise of black chefs is, without a doubt, the most important story in American restaurants right now. People in food media are all finally talking about it. 5 years ago? Nobody was, says J.J. Johnson, who was running the kitchen at the Cecil back then. Nobody even knew how to talk about it. Innovation be damned. Johnson failed to win the Beard Foundation's Rising Star Prize in 2015. I still think I was robbed, he says. I don't think anyone was cooking better than me. But vindication arrived this year when Johnson and Alexander Smalls, the chef, food scholar, and former opera singer who'd mentored him, won a Beard Award for Between Harlem and Heaven, a cookbook that's rooted in the menu they created together at the Cecil. All of which is to say that it would be unwise to bet against J.J. Johnson. The man can cook, duh, but at 35 he's also one of the few young chefs in America with the ability to look forward, beyond the burrata and avocado toast clichés that mire so many stateside menus in dullness. And what Johnson sees on the horizon is rice. Field Trip, his new globe-trotting temple devoted to the greatest grain, is located in a storefront on Lenox Avenue in Harlem, about 5 minutes on foot from where Johnson used to cook. The voluminous education that went into Between Harlem and Heaven wound up leading him down a rabbit hole of rice paddy research, and today he can hold forth on the historical pathways and cooking methods connected to black rice, sticky rice, Texas brown rice, Carolina gold, aged basmati, you name it. He's looking to source rice from Brazil, Trinidad, Vermont, wherever he can get the best stuff. The idea came to him while, quote, traveling so much and seeing what rice was at the center of the table, unquote. The cultural centrality of rice is far from new, of course, but Johnson's continent-hopping mashups, think Texas brown rice with brisket, black beans, and turmeric yogurt, could represent a fast casual concept that actually has legs. In Harlem, he sees his primary competition as Shake Shack and Chipotle. "I don't want to teach anymore," he told me when I visited Field Trip in late spring. Yet Johnson, who also has a restaurant south of Midtown, Henry, at the Life Hotel, still can't help but find himself in the position of spreading the gospel. "Y'all open?" a woman asked as she passed the front door. "No," he said, "3 weeks." "It's a restaurant?" she went on. "It's a rice bowl shop," he explained. "Global flavors." Maybe 5 years from now, as with the Cecil, he won't have to explain anymore. "I hope this place can expand into other neighborhoods like this," he told me. "I look to Wolfgang Puck in terms of trajectory. I'm going to disturb a bunch of markets in different ways." As I said, I wouldn't bet against him. J.J. Johnson has a knack for sensing where everything is going, even when the rest of us don't. And that's it from this current episode of Esquire. We'll come back to the September issue next time. This is Jay Stowe signing off. Have a great weekend.